It is Saturday, September 27th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, we have a discussion with author Bill Tanzer all about internet trends. He has a book called Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we have author Bill Tanzer on. He is talking about his unexpected insights for business and life about millions of people online clicking and looking at what they're doing. So the book is Click, and it's about internet analysis, and he's got some fascinating insights on how we think and how we act online, and possibly how that enlightens us to what we're actually doing and thinking in life. So that's with Bill Tanzer in just a minute. But first, we're going to do some geek news. And the second half, you're welcome to call us and ask us questions about the topic at hand. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org to send us email. And I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me are geeks. Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sean. Rick Kleffel, host of KOSP's Agony Column and his well-known book review website of the same name.
Good morning.
We also have Miles Elam. Miles is no longer a slacker. He's working really hard teaching, and he's a student as well and a political junkie. Miles, morning.
Good morning.
And of course, we also have our guest, Bill Tanzer, and he's going to sit here, and you're welcome to participate if you'd like, Bill.
Thanks, Lyle, and thanks for having me on the show.
Certainly. All right, so let's start the news off with you, Sean.
Yeah, I kind of want to start it off with a gripe. So it turns out that Governor Schwarzenegger has passed a bill on Wednesday outlawing text messaging while driving.
So you want people to drive along at 50 texting miles?
No, he wants to be able to drive along.
Maybe there should be a test for people. If they can't pass texting while driving, then maybe
okay,
they can't
text. Wait. You sound like an evil person right now. So explain to me, how are you texting while driving?
I only text at stoplights. But, you know, I'm driving an hour to work, you know, an hour home. Mm-hmm. I'm in San Tomas, and I'm stopping at every light. And I'm waiting.
Right.
And now I can't text? Oh, it's horrible.
Okay, so
so you're the guy that I'm honking at because you're sitting there texting.
No, I'm really good about that. No. When the cars move.
You're good at it now because you take your tech device, you put it up close, so your peripheral vision picks up the stoplight.
See,
right?
It makes it worse. I'm going to be looking low now.
So you're going to break the law, Sean? Can I get that
right? Of course I am. Yes.
Sean's a good guy.
He's
a great father. What's the real news, Sean? You want me to go to Miles?
Yeah, no. Actually, I do have a real news story. Because I know we go to Miles and we're just going to get...
I know we're going to get political.
Yeah, we started talking this morning. We're like, oh, save it for the news. All right, so Comcast has worked with the FCC, and I guess the FCC has approved their approach to dealing with heavy download bandwidth users. These people, we already talked about this, I think 2 weeks ago. They're going to cap 250 gigabytes of download a month. So they figure that's about 100 times the average user consumes, which is about 62,500 songs, 125 standard definition movies. So those people who are downloading really heavy, 250 gigabytes a month, so what happens to them? So they figured out that what they're going to do is they're going to put them on a different feed. And those heaviest people during congested periods are going to have their bandwidth throttled.
But they're not going to start charging them for more, or are they just going to throttle them?
It sounds like they're just going to throttle them. I know we talked about them charging.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if both happened.
You know, it seems to me, is this still the cable company?
This is Comcast.
See, it seems to me Comcast makes a decision, and then they get this horrible press, and then they seem to change their decision a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of interesting. I think it makes a lot of sense to say, okay, if you're a high-end user, let us know. We're not going to charge you more. We're going to put you in a special network and throttle you if bandwidth gets high.
So that I think that's a better solution.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Than charging. And especially if they're not going to give you a tool or a way to track how much you've downloaded. Where are you at in the month?
Right. Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, a very easy tool to do so would simply, over time, like you go very fast, and then as you start hitting the as you get past like 50%, they throttle you back a little bit, and then
just use an inverse parabolic curve.
So you can just look and see like, oh, well, I'm not getting 600 kilobytes.
Yeah, we all have Comcast accounts.
Now I'm getting 300.
Mm-hmm. If you've got a Comcast account, go to a web page. Comcast tells you at any point in time. I mean, if they're keeping track of the data, why can't they make that
really
available?
Seriously?
No, that's what they should do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Sean's right. If they're keeping track of the data, then why don't they provide that data to you?
Yeah. I agree. Well, thank you, Sean, for that story.
Yeah.
Miles, hate to ask, but what's up with intellectual – oh, wait, that's bad, right? What's up with copyright? What's up with copyright,
well,
trademark, and patent?
It's the term intellectual property, mm-hmm. which refers to trademark, copyright, and patent, even though there are three areas of law that have very little to do with one another, other than the fact that they're all imaginary.
Trademark is a very specific rule that I think you and I agree with 100%.
All three of them I agree with
lay down real quickly. Trademark is a commerce thing so that you know the product you're getting is from a company that's invested a lot of time and energy into that product name. So no one else can sell stuff under the name Coca-Cola that has to do with soft drinks.
Right.
Very good idea. It's implemented pretty well. We're doing okay with it. And copyright, or let's do with patents. Patents are doing pretty well except for software patents.
Right.
Okay. So what's the news about this?
The Senate has passed a bill that they're referring to as the Pro-IP Act. And while there was a provision earlier about how they're going to have the Department of Justice prosecute intellectual property law through it, mm-hmm. There was a lot of pushback from that because that was going to be the Department of Justice taking care of civil cases. In other words, acting as a legal arm for an industry, in this case, the entertainment industry and the like.
Right.
Rather than acting as a criminal or something that would be more useful of our
legislative
dollars or executive dollars, huh?
So that was kind of shot down.
That was shot down. That was removed from it. But now it still contains increased penalties for infringement. So if you are guilty of copyright infringement, it's going to hit you harder than, let's say, if you, held up a liquor store.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also civil forfeiture provisions, which are very worrisome. This is actually, to me, it seems fairly reminiscent of drug war, that if you are guilty of, in their terminology, trafficking in copyrighted material illegally, then you can have goods in your home or your computer or your network or I don't know what the limits are mm-hmm. currently. I need to research that. That can be seized from you. In much the same way that we've heard from the drug war, people will have some pot and they would lose their home.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you download a few songs and...
What about...
Well, right now they're talking about it as with regards to large organized crime. This is the main focus of the bill, mm-hmm. is these groups that their sole purpose is to get copyrighted material and they're making money off of it.
Is that even happening?
No, that is absolutely happening.
Is it happening in the U.S.?
Yes.
Wait, so people are stealing content and then selling it? Because all the copyright infringement
making it available, but they're not making
money off of it. So it's not a criminal organization in the sense that there's a lot of finances
except
there.
Except that if you have a site that is making this stuff available and you have ads, you are making money off of it.
Ah, yeah.
So at the same time, legislation like this in the past has eventually led to individuals.
Right.
Where it isn't going after a large conglomeration.
The law is for a conglomeration, but really it comes down to a person.
Right. It becomes a convenience thing if you want to go after someone. And mm-hmm. they're also implementing an IP czar, so an entirely new position.
Intellectual property czar, which would actually handle patents as well and trademarks?
In theory, because they're talking about intellectual property.
That's
they're all lumped together.
Okay.
And
now, Miles,
he would be coordinating enforcement of this.
Yeah, Rick?
Miles, is this the same law that has the DOJ going after civil claims, acting as pro bono lawyers for the civil claims?
That was the original provision that was struck down.
Oh, so they struck that down.
Yeah, so that part of it has
been
pulled down.
That's
but
good.
There's still some aspects of that that are remaining. But that the part that you were referring to, the part that we were worried about, has been ratcheted back quite a bit.
Good, good.
All right. Well, thank you, Miles, for that
so
update.
If you don't want this to pass, if you think this is a bad idea, now is the time to be contacting your local representative and telling them to vote no.
All right. And, Miles, right after the show, if I give you my laptop, because your laptop is broken, will you put some links up about contacting representatives in the area of California that we cover?
Certainly.
Thank you very much. All right. And just to be clear, I want to kind of make a mandate that we stop using the term intellectual property. I think it's one of those words that actually is owned by a certain side, and I don't think that should be something we use. So we should talk about copyright and trademark and patent. That's fine. But
right.
Let's try
talk
to
about
stop
copyright
using the term.
Law or that's right. patent law.
All right. Thank you, Miles. Rick, do you have some news today?
Oh, absolutely. I've got some news about a couple of forthcoming books. These are coming out in February. There are two books that I think a lot of your listeners are going to want to look for. One is called Little Bee. It's by an author named Chris Cleave. He came to prominence when on 7/7, a couple years ago, he released his first book, Incendiary, which was about British terrorism on British soil on the day of the 7/7 bombings. And it was his book was really beautiful. That first book, Incendiary, was really beautiful and also very funny and surreal. It created a kind of alternate present of the UK vision of the UK with dirigibles floating overhead to stop terrorism. It was really kind of scary and eerie. He has a new book coming out in February called Little Bee. We don't know anything about this book except for, and what this is what's really intriguing about it. On the back cover of a book, they're usually going to tell you much of the plot. This book says, not only doesn't tell you the plot, it says, don't tell, once you've read this book, don't tell other people about the plot.
It's going to be a hard one to interview, right?
Yeah, it's going to be a difficult interview. On the other hand, I did read enough of this book to get that this is really funny. He's very, very funny, and he's very insightful. This book is about the refugee situation in the UK, and it looks to be very interesting. That'll be coming out in February. Okay. The other really big piece of news is Dan Simmons. Now, Dan Simmons is a longtime science fiction writer. His breakthrough book came out in the mid-'80s. It was called Hyperion. Unfortunately, Dan Simmons has a kind of a habit of changing his career, going from writing science fiction, he'll write a horror novel. And then everybody say, you're the next Stephen King, Dan. When's your next novel coming out? He follows that up with a mystery novel. They'll say, you're the next Jim Thompson, Dan. When's your next mystery coming out? And then he follows that up with another science fiction novel. Well, this is kind of unusual. His last novel was a piece of historical fiction called The Terror, which was about the voyage of the Endeavor into the Arctic.
Is this the one about Charles Dickens?
Yeah, he's got a new book coming out called Drood. And it's all about Charles Dickens, his last days when Charles Dickens took a very dark turn in his life. It's an 800-page book, and it is brilliantly written. It's beautiful, and it also incorporates his trademark ability to integrate slight supernatural twists with really deeply and richly evoked
it's
history.
It's interesting. I wonder if the concept of using Drood means he's not going to finish it, because I don't think Dickens actually finished Drood. I think he passed away before he was able to finish the book.
Well,
the Mystery of Edwin Drood?
Yes, yeah. The book actually is finished.
Uh-huh, good.
But what's interesting is it's narrated by Dickens' contemporary, Wilkie Collins. And I talked to Simmons briefly, and he said he was so happy to be out of the laudanum-addled addict's head after having written for him for 14 months.
Well, that would be great. Oh, well, thank you, Rick, for those recommendations. So Dan Simmons, Drood, and Little Bee is by who?
Chris Cleave.
Thank you. We'll take a look for those. And let's go ahead and get on to the book at hand
actually,
today.
I have a new story that ties in with all
well,
what we're talking about today.
Sean, please.
Happens that Hitwise, the company that Bill works at, as a general manager of research?
Global research.
Did a story last week on Wednesday about Facebook and MySpace. So they were tracking where are people going? You know, what are they using these days? And they saw that Facebook has seen their traffic increase 50% in the U.S. since last August. And not so good news is that Facebook has gone down, or MySpace has gone down, but there's still 67.5% of the social networking market in the U.S. So MySpace is still on top. Facebook is growing fast. And the next three, My Yearbook, Tagged, and Bebo, are less than 2%. So, I mean, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a custom category of the top social networks we tracked. We actually track about 5,500
And it just happens yesterday. I was surfing through the bottom of that list to find out what are some of the niche social networks that people are belonging to.
And that's us?
Well, no. It's surprising. There's a social network called Glock Talk, which is a social network devoted to
the Glock pistol.
There's,
oh, my gosh.
There's Divorce 360, which is a divorce social network. There's Smokers. I can't remember. Smokers Welcome. There's a site devoted to pro-smoking site, the social network. It's amazing the niche sites that are showing up in that category.
Wow.
5,500. We were just looking at the top 55, I believe, when we did this report.
Yeah,
the last two make a lot of sense to me, considering the number of people who have been divorced and then the number of smokers that are now relegated to being outside in this ostracized group. I could totally see that being a very well-connected group.
Yeah, and this is actually something we're studying, and my wife's in the studio. I was just mentioning this to her when we were in New York. I've seemed to have noticed a lot of more smoking just recently. And I'm guessing there's probably some correlation between increased smoking and economic troubles that we're facing.
Oh, interesting.
I haven't proved it out yet, but I'm actually going to dive into the data to see if I can prove that out.
Yeah. So our guest today is Bill Tanser. He has written a book, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters, Click, Unexpected Insights for Business and Life. And I got to say that I've been reading the book, and it's great. You've got wonderful stories about looking at giant sets of data. And I just want to be clear that the way that Hitwise captures the data is kind of complicated. It is anonymous, and except for some people that are actually kind of signed up to the program to get more details. That's how we know age groups and things of that nature. And I put a link on the geekspeak.org website on today's show about exactly how you do what you do. Great little article you've got on your site. So let's not get into how you actually get all the data. But with this data, you're able to ask a question like how many people are visiting a certain site that are also visiting another site and see a graph about that over time. That's the general stuff, right?
That's right. We're tracking about 1 million different websites visited by 10 million internet users in the U.S., divided into 172 different industry categories and tracked by the month, week, and even down to the day.
Wow.
And I've got this wonderful job. I get to just jump in and play with this data every day and find interesting trends.
Okay, so I know you've already talked about this quite a bit, but I think the prom dress is pretty interesting. So can you tell me a bit about the prom dress?
Yeah, so I've got a bit of an obsession with prom dress data online. And my wife, I know, is very concerned about this obsession. But to tell you the story, the short version of the story, I tasked one of my analysts to I asked her to analyze all the search terms driving traffic to retail sites in a given period. And she had a couple 100,000 terms to analyze. Mm-hmm. I asked her, what was the top generic term by category that people were looking for going to these retail sites?
And category meaning like apparel.
Right.
It would be okay.
Yeah. Or even down, I want to know what specifically, what's the top generic thing people are looking for? So I don't want brands. I want to know what.
But in a category of apparel, of clothing.
This was actually all retail sites.
Oh, really? All retail sites. Okay, go on.
She came back, and you know, to your point of you know, thinking it's just apparel, she came back kind of shocked, and she said the number one thing that people are searching for, just thing, is prom dresses. And I thought, okay, that's really strange. And she says, no, it gets stranger. It's January is when we pulled this data. And so we did a little chart on searches for prom dresses, and every single year it spikes in January. And before, I really had no interest in prom dresses whatsoever, but at this point I cleared my desk and it was all about prom dresses. And it remained so for like 2 to 3 years. I'm studying prom dresses. The first thing I did is I called up some retailers that sell prom dresses, and I said, when do you market these things? And they said from March to May.
So all the marketing hits March and May, and of course prom happens in June, July areas.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, in end of May.
And so January is the spike?
So I have this file folder of unsolved mysteries in my desk, and this is in there. And one of the things I do when I go out and speak at conferences, sometimes I'll put up one of these charts. I do it at a travel conference.
Yeah,
here's
you do
a
actually pretty
chart.
Yeah.
So I did this at an online publishers meeting.
Well, I heard that you were asking a lot of people.
I was asking a lot of people. Yeah.
Because you're really trying to get down to the bottom of this. Right?
Exactly. So, you know, this one meeting where I put the, I throw the chart up. An older gentleman comes to me, very distinguished looking guy, hands me a card, and he says, son, I'm all about prom dresses.
Your answer came true, yeah.
Yeah, I found like my prom dress doppelganger. And he says, you know, my industry actually caused this trend you're seeing. And so I looked at his card. He was the GM of a magazine division, a teen magazine division. He said, you know what we've done? Our advertising used to be, our season was from March to May. But that's the most lucrative time for our magazine titles, is that period to sell prom dress advertisements. So what we've done is we've changed consumer behavior. We started hitting the newsstands the first week of January with these fashion editions.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that over several years, we've changed consumer behavior. Girls are now searching for prom dresses as soon as January.
Okay, so See, the publishing industry does this, sells a little ads, but the actual retail doesn't know?
That was the coolest thing, is that the designers knew, because that's who the magazines were selling their ads to, but the retailers themselves were going off their bricks and mortar store traffic, and they didn't realize
that. And the retailers, I mean, really, without figuring, it's hard for them to figure out. They can, of course, I mean, the way businesses traditionally do this is they do random calling surveys and ask questions. But that's a hard market to hit because you're talking about teenagers.
Right.
And also, they might do the survey in May and get that, people are interested in May. They're just not as interested as in January.
And I think you're giving retailers a lot of credit. A lot of them, at least in our experience, just go off of gut feel.
Yeah.
They go off of what they've experienced in their stores.
Analyzing large sets of data, it's hard not to do gut feel. In fact, I noticed that in a lot of your writing, that you're doing a sample that's not like scientific response. It's a gut feeling. I agree with it. I think it's probably pretty valid. There's actually an example that I noticed in your index. You talk about where was this great little mention? You talked about recommend about New Year, the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. Having people search for diet for a week, and then they stop. New Year's resolutions.
Yep.
And then they stop talking about diet. And your assumption, probably pretty valid, that people last about a week and then they stop doing it. But my thought was, it's possible that everyone goes on a diet and they just don't need to learn anymore because their diet's working great, and so they only search for it for a week. So it's that kind of assumptions where I see where you're coming from, and from a scientific perspective, it's not the way you do science. But in any case, I've been loving your book. I didn't mean to critique you too hard.
No, that's okay. And the way we do a lot of these things that we've come up with, some of it just sort of happens in the data. We see it in the data. We start pursuing it. But usually we start with a hypothesis and we test it the best we can. Now, a lot of times we just find correlations. And, of course, that does not make a causation.
Right.
So there's ways that we can try and limit the variables and get to causation. But you're right. You never can actually prove that causation. So
right. And I guess the searching, once you really believed your data, I'm sure you kind of were questioning whether your prom dress data was correct in January. But once you got confirmation from it, you had a lot more faith in the system. At some point, if something comes up like that and you have no reason, no understanding of why it's happening, it still doesn't matter. It's still important for the marketers to change their website to put prom dresses up, even if you don't know why it's happening.
Right. Yeah, exactly right.
So you kind of got famous just the last couple days on the internet because you got a lot of hits to your site. Well, why are you getting a lot of hits to your site right now?
Well, along with being the GM of research at Hitwise, I also write a column for Time magazine called The Science of Search. And right after Sarah Palin was named to the ticket, I decided to go into our data, do a little analysis. Saw a massive spike in searches on Sarah Palin. We covered a lot about this story, just the surge in searches on her. She surpassed all of the other candidates, even surpassed Paris Hilton, Britney Spears in terms of volume of searches.
Okay.
Here's an example of going into the data with a hypothesis. My hypothesis when I saw the spike was that Sarah Palin, complete unknown to most of us. So a lot of people probably trying to find information about her.
Makes sense.
Right? That's my hypothesis. Going to test it. One of the things I can do with Hitwise data is I can say of the 4 million search terms we're capturing any given week, filter all those terms just for whatever I'm looking at. So I said, for Sarah Palin, show me the different ways people are searching for her. The breadth of searches in Sarah Palin is pretty impressive, about 14,000 unique ways that people were searching for her, and I could order them in terms of volume. Here's a surprising thing. When I looked through the data, the number one thing that people were looking for by category was pictures of Sarah Palin. And to get more specific, hot pictures of Sarah Palin.
Uh-huh.
Their searches for bikini pictures, Sarah Palin, beauty pageant pictures, Sarah Palin, hot pictures, Sarah Palin. So I wrote my Time column just about this exact topic. Being addicted to data, of course, checking Google Analytics on a regular basis, and I just saw for this week, had about 68,000 visits to my site based on that term, Sarah Palin hot photos.
So some search engine is putting you high in the ranking.
Yeah, it's actually MSN was where all the traffic was coming from. I was the number one search on Sarah Palin, I think it was Thursday of this week, and that was this massive amount of traffic.
So, and your article's all about how the reason Sarah Palin's getting traffic, internet traffic, is because people are looking for adult content.
It was that. I think the theme running through my article, though, is that if you look at search term data around politics today, specifically around the candidates, it's not so much about the issues. It's about things like image.
Yeah. Well,
it's about superficial things like how tall is Barack Obama?
Yeah. You gave a great example, actually, in this that I hadn't really put together, and I guess you have some numbers behind it, which is kind of cool, that Barack Obama was getting more searches about religion, had more references to religion, even though there's not a lot of controversy around the real Barack about, he's a Christian and all that. But it was around because of the story about him being Muslim as a child or going to a
And this was a fascinating story. So if you remember back, January 2007, there's a story that Insight magazine wrote up that Obama had attended a madrasa that was run by extremist Muslims. And that was debunked. Yeah. It was debunked 4 days later by CNN. Yet if you looked at the search terms around Barack Obama the week before that story broke, there was little mention of his religion within search term data. Right after, of course, about... I think it was six of the top 10 search terms had some question about his religion. The interesting thing about it, though, is the half-life of that information. That lasted for about a year until it...
4 days of untrue story generates a year of interest.
About a year of interest on that specific topic. So it really lived on. It's died down now. The one thing that was interesting we found about Obama that I also wrote a Time column about the week before is this Obama Antichrist rumor. So... it was the number six search term on Obama out of, I think, 11,000 unique searches. Number six was Obama Antichrist. I hadn't heard of this before, so I Googled it. And come to find out, one of my colleagues at Time Magazine had actually written an article about it. And she had blamed a McCain ad for actually causing this controversy. And that was in the summer. This ad was out that had kind of these overtones to it. That may have been inferring that Obama is the Antichrist. Charting search term data, though, we were actually able to disprove that. It did spike around the time of that ad, but the first spike happened all the way in January.
And where would it come from?
We don't know. We can see that circulating via email. Here's the interesting thing that we found, though. Using Hitwise data, I can tell where people go in aggregate when they search on the term. Guess what the number one site people are going to when searching on the term?
I would go to Snoop. No, I wouldn't. I would ignore it.
No, Snopes.
Snopes.
Snopes is it. 20% of the people searching on that term went to Snopes, which is somewhat distressing to think that people actually need to debunk.
Yeah, you don't need to debunk that. Right. Yeah.
And I'll save your listeners some trouble. If you go to Snopes, they did declare it false. So Obama is not the Antichrist. He's not
the other thing I thought was interesting, you talked about in your book about this religion and Obama and search terms, is that Mike Huckabee, who at the time, it's the election? The
primaries.
The primaries, right? So Huckabee is the same level of interest in some sense. And he was a preacher, like a minister. So you'd think that he'd have higher search results for religion because he's a religious guy. I mean, and for a profession. But no, that's not the case. It was Obama because of these crazy stories.
You know, I just did a Google Trends on Obama Antichrist and... Yeah.
Now, Google Trends kind of does a little bit about what Hitwise does. Let's talk more about that. You're welcome to call us with questions and comments about our topic today. We're talking about internet searching. We're talking about some pretty fascinating data that's available to us all, and also about what Bill does at Hitwise. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Dr. Don Motika, announcing OptimageHealth.com in Santa Cruz, a functional medicine practice and consultation service. Combining an array of modalities to achieve and maintain wellness. Appointments available at OptimageHealth.com. And Don's actually asked me to come in and check out my health, and so maybe I'll do a little geek report on that next week. Imagine the Marx Brothers answering questions about cars. Picture of Monty Python trying to imitate engine sounds. Mix that up with a little Dr. Ruth and some Smothers Brothers, and you've got Car Talk. You can hear Click and Clack give their advice on cars every Saturday right after Geek Speak at 11 and Sunday morning at 9 a.m. right here on KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. We are inviting you to join the conversation. Ask us anything you'd like about internet searches and trends, and maybe a little bit about what people are thinking and why they're thinking that in mass. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-KUSP. The geeks this morning, Rick Kleffel.
Hi. Now,
Sean, wait, I'm going to interview you, and I'll throw the mic to you. Sean Cleveland. We also have Bill Tanzer. He's the author of Click. And we have Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. And the phone number is one more time, 476-2800, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Rick, yeah, go for it.
Bill, tell us about prism categories.
Prism categories. It's one of my favorite topics. One of the things we can do with our data is we've matched it with this system called Claritas Prism Clusters. And Claritas has taken the U.S. population and divided it into 66 different segments. So they go in order of affluence from number one, the upper crust, down to low-rise living, number 66. And some of my favorites in between, like number 51, which is the shotguns and pickup segment.
Is it kind of comical? Or
It is. You know, you can search backwards in our data. You can say, show me the top sites visited by segment 51, shotguns and pickups. And it's just like it sounds. You get visits to gun sites, visits to wrestling sites.
So this analysis of all these different numbers, these are sites that have to do with those topics? How do you figure out who goes where?
Well, you just in terms of matching up those segments to the sample.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we can just in reverse say for that sample, show us where they go. Now, here's a really cool kind of geek speak application of that data. Is in the book, we did an analysis of early adopters. So we had this idea, you know, if we could roll back our data before YouTube was really well known. So take October 2005, right before it really hit big time in November. We could examine by segment who was visiting the site. So we did that, and we also did that for a bunch of other Web 2.0 sites before they were hot.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that we were able to isolate who the innovators and early adopters are. Then the cool thing is you can take that same group and reverse search today to find out what are they doing.
Yep.
And that might give us an indication of what's going to be hot
tomorrow.
What's
the next big hot thing, Bill?
Well, it's interesting. We did this exercise just about 2 weeks ago again. And one of the things I found fascinating is when I reverse search on groups like the Young Digerati, which is one of the early adopter segments, the Bohemian Mix, the place they were going within multimedia was they were going to a lot of sites that provided a directory of online videos, kind of a layer above YouTube to provide you with some direction as to what's cool to watch on YouTube. And I found a number of different types of these sites that they were visiting. It's almost like the early adopters are showing an early demand for some way to filter out and find interesting content that maybe YouTube isn't doing enough by just telling us what's popular and providing a search. There's so much out there, we need some direction as to where to go to find the best stuff.
Yeah.
So that might be a hot area.
So here's a question. Do you think that happened before YouTube? Because there's actually quite a few video sharing things. YouTube's the one that won. But could you potentially look at the people that are kind of spread across these different new indexing of videos, take one of those and look at all the people that are going to that site and then see what they were doing before YouTube and see if there was people that, you know, are lost that didn't do the YouTube choice right away, even as an early adopter?
Yeah, you could. You could reverse search back that way, too. Yeah. And, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's this it's a great book called Diffusion of Innovation. It was published back in the 70s by Ev Rogers, the late Ev Rogers. And he came up with this Diffusion of Innovation curve that shows you that products go through different steps in adoption. There's innovators and early adopters, then early majority, late majority. And we're doing things now like isolating not just the early adopters, but the early midstream or mainstream. We can actually see the crossover happen. So we can actually see this pattern that Ev Rogers talked about in the 70s actually playing out in the data live, which is just fascinating. I think going to be really useful, probably one of the most useful things you can do with this data.
Let's go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz. Hal, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning. This is fascinating. Great, great stuff. I heard your guest mention that he uses Google Analytics to look at who's coming to his site and for what, and I do too, and I wanted to ask for some tips and tricks to do that more effectively, and also are there any alternatives?
Well, yeah, I'm addicted to data, so anywhere I can get data, I get it.
And, yeah, me too.
And Google Analytics is a great tool, and it's free, which is the other great thing about it. I found, to my own personal experience, the bounce rate is probably one of the most useful statistics. It tells you what your percentage is of users that just go to the first page and then churn off immediately and go off to another domain. It's so useful because as you adjust content on your site, you can actually see that bounce rate change. And if you watch that with some very rudimentary testing, you can kind of figure out what type of content is going to engage
your... What kind of testing?
Just changing the content on your website, changing its display, changing what you're featuring above the fold when people first log in, and then see what happens to that bounce rate as you change your content.
Okay.
That's probably one of the exercises I conduct the most. Then, of course, I love looking at the geographic information. So you can drill down and look at maps worldwide, even down to metropolitan areas and cities, and look to see where people are coming from. Looking at your search campaign, of course, is probably the most valuable thing you can do with Google Analytics if you're doing a paid search campaign on Google.
On Google
What's
AdWords?
A search campaign?
Yeah. If you're doing a Google AdWords search campaign, just going the next step, you can actually measure conversions. If you're selling something online or if you're trying to get people to take a specific action, Google Analytics will give you the ability to actually measure the conversion rate or the percent of visitors that actually do the action that you want them to.
And how Google AdWords, there's Google AdWords too, which also does this, where the basic idea is that when Google places text ads on different people's sites based off of what's on there, what kind of content on there. And the other thing you can do with Google is you can actually buy search result names. So you might buy fancy car, and anytime somebody searches for fancy car, you get the high traffic ad on Google's page on the right-hand side. And then you can see with Google Analytics and using that the Google AdWords, you can see then how much that's turning into people visiting your site. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about to some degree.
Yeah, I'm not selling anything on my site and don't take ads, so I don't know. Some of that's not strictly applicable.
Play around with the bounce rate, because you want people to read what you have on your site.
Should I look at the search terms that brought them there and then try and figure out how to retain them based on that term?
Yeah, take a look at the search terms.
Good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Look at the search terms, and then maybe do one other thing. You know, kind of a the cheap way of doing what we do in kind of a industrial strength product at Hitwise is you can go to Google Trends and then chart some of those terms that you see driving traffic to your site, and you'll get a sense of the seasonality of those search terms, their volume compared to other things. So trends.google.com will help you actually measure that.
Here's some feedback for the geeks. I went to Firefox because of the guys recommending it, and I find the browser being used to find me, there's a lot more Firefox and a lot less Internet Explorer than I would have expected.
Yeah, and we've seen this in other data sources. Servers actually measure the browser that's being used to access the server, and there's a number of sites that give you the statistics of Explorer versus Mozilla versus
Google
Safari.
Google Analytics does that.
Yeah, so they're probably just probably taking that data in from the Google servers.
I was always kind of surprised with the GeekSpeak website that we actually still, I think, get more Internet Explorer visitors than Firefox visitors. Yeah,
I would have thought that would be
you'd think that you'd have a higher. Yeah. I think that's because we have so many people, so many times we're talking about stuff that's helping out people, like on the phone and stuff. Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, not early adopters. They're people that are just average computer users, and they're looking for help. And those average computer users are not using Firefox.
I'm sucking up every word you guys say. So.
thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, which was doubly amazing considering that Internet Explorer was broken on our site for quite a while.
What do you mean was broken?
That's because it held back our innovation for a long time. You'd be so upset because we want to do something, yet we're going to break the site if we do it for a lot of people.
On the contrary, there was a lot of people talk about, well, Internet Explorer is most of the market, but when I was originally doing the redesign for the site years ago, saying Internet Explorer, I think 5.5 was the one version at that time, when Internet Explorer 6.0 came out, it broke the site.
Yeah.
It wasn't about coding for IE. It was coding for each version of IE.
So I want to talk about the data itself. We haven't done this yet.
I'd love to talk about
that. Yeah. So how many people are we talking about? Where does the data come from? And how do you get specifics out of that? You know, male, age groups, that sort of thing. It's a lot of questions.
So the data, in terms of the size of the data, 10 million internet users U.S., 25 million worldwide. The methodology that Hitwise has is a little bit different than others that do audience measurement, companies like Comscore and Nielsen. What we do is our primary methodology is agreements with ISPs, software is installed on their networks that anonymizes and aggregates the HTTP requests that are coming across their servers, dumps it to our server where we can slice and dice it. Now, we have to remove ourselves several levels from the data, so we actually contract that data out so that we can't see any personally identifiable information, only the aggregate data, such as this percent of U.S. internet users went to MySpace versus Facebook. We have another set of data that supplements the ISP data, and that's an opt-in set of data. We also contract for that as well and remove ourselves from the collection of the data. But here, people have actually filled out surveys to tell us who they are by gender, by income, by age bracket. And we get that data back, and we can then cross-tab our data to say, okay, show us where affluent internet users went. That also provides us with the PRISM codes we were talking about. So I can say, you know, show me where shotguns and pickup segments went online. So by group or cluster.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I'm wondering, Bill, with the rise of social networking websites, we have a different form of data. I mean, people are putting stuff out that's personal, that's misspelled, that's odd and strange. Could you talk about trying to go through that kind of data as opposed to what was previously put on the internet?
Yeah, you know, that's a very good point, is that with Web 2.0, with sites becoming more and more interactive, people are supplying a lot of data just to be viewed by the public in general. There's actually some tools, like you can go, you know, another way of doing some free analysis, you can go to Facebook Lexicon, which allows you to chart terms that people are discussing within Facebook itself to get a sense, the same sense that I get from internet data overall, to what's being discussed on social networks. But you're right, it's a massive amount of data. There's good things and bad things to that. The good thing from my perspective is just there's more data for us to crunch to figure out what is making us tick. The bad side to it is that with that information explosion, it's getting a lot harder to actually find good information.
Now, also, we've all been talking so far, I think, about text data, right? Do you foresee a time when you can process image data and other forms of data, sound?
Yeah, I think we're just at the infancy of doing what is possible with this data. And I think, yeah, there's definitely opportunities. There's a lot of companies now just starting up that are finding ways to catalog and process image data, for example, voice data. I think, yeah, we're just at the nascent stage of doing this analysis, and there's just going to be more and more opportunity to analyze.
We're speaking with Bill Tanzer. He's the author of Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. There's more information about the subject up on our website, including more details about how they collect their data. We also have Miles Elam, Rick Kleffel. I'm Lyle Troxell, and Sean Cleveland.
Yeah, this kind of ties in with what Rick was just asking. And it's funny that Miles, Lyle, and I talked about this in the ride coming up down to the show today. And that's that the search terms that people are using. A lot of times those first searches they do are no good. So they're actually going back and changing the search terms. And Lyle mentioned, you know, when he does a Google search, he never goes. Well, you don't go deep.
I don't go past like two pages.
Yeah, and Miles and I don't either. Mm-hmm. So instead of going deeper into that search term, we'll just do a whole new search. So when you're looking at your data, I mean, is there a way that you can determine that somebody did that?
Yeah, we actually have a metric that measures that. It's called success rate within Hitwise Speak. And what we do is we will tag any search terms in which somebody searched and then returned immediately to a search engine to search again is tagged as an unsuccessful search. And we actually provide a metric of all search terms, what percent success versus...
I see. So if they didn't follow past the first, you know, if they didn't click in the Google page and actually go somewhere...
Instead, they executed another search. It's tagged as unsuccessful. So
do you know then what... let's say they make a search term, it's failure, they go change their search term, and then they end up going to a page. You kind of know that page should really show up in that first search term group, right?
You could infer that. And the way our clients will use this data is they'll look for opportunities that are being missed right now. Like, for example, I remember seeing one just the other week of a misspelling of Canon. The camera brand, that it was misspelled and the success rate was extremely low. It was like 5%. So a lot of people apparently typing with this misspelling and not seeing any results to click on, then going and redoing their search, probably spelling it right using the suggestion within Google. But a marketer might look at that and say, you know what, we should be buying that misspelling because we can probably put our data, our search listing there and get a lot of that traffic.
Canon cameras, right?
Yeah.
Could you talk about... in your book, you talk about how examining this data allows you to get at the decision-making process. That's a really fascinating idea.
Yeah, it's not just the decision-making process, but a lot of really interesting things. You know, probably my favorite chapter to write was the fear chapter, how-to. Yeah. You know, here's the thing is, and this we had this idea one day when we're looking at our data, and again, this is an example of us just being allowed to play with the data to find something interesting. Millions of search terms crossing our servers, and we decided... What if we filtered this list by something like fear of? Because I think we saw one instance of a fear of search, and we thought, well, maybe people are searching on their fears, so let's filter all these million terms by just fear of. And the surprise when we did that is we found 1,300 unique fears that people were searching on in this one little period. We could also rank them in terms of popularity. So we did that, and right away, the first thing that struck me is I want to compare this to surveys on fears.
Sure.
And my list was very different from the traditional survey of fears. What we found is that on our list, there's a lot of social fears showed up.
Like what?
Things like, you know, fear of being alone, fear of intimacy, fear of other people, fear of groups. You think about it a second, and if we talk about representativeness and traditional surveys, where you're doing maybe a telephone survey, you're probably not going to get social fear sufferers to participate in a telephone survey.
Right.
And if you do, they're probably not going to admit to those fears. And that also shows up in the tail of this list. You know, it's really interesting when you get to, like, term 1,000 and beyond. Things like fear of belly button lint. and fear of elbows, fear of necks,
wow.
fear of ceiling fans. Again, people aren't going to probably admit to irrational fears in a survey, yet they show up
uh-huh.
in search term data.
I'm sorry, I have to ask. Fear of elbows. How does that work?
If you're a hockey player, I think.
Do they stare at themselves and go,
Miles, you're making fun of someone's fear.
No, I realize it, but I don't understand.
It's very insensitive.
Is it fear of someone else's elbow, someone else elbowing them as an attack?
Do they actually go to a page that helps them?
They do. You know, it's hard when you get into the long tail because we're not going to capture much data on fear of elbows. Mm-hmm. But one thing I found was a fear of long words. I actually started doing some Google searches myself on these fears to see what had come up. And there's a lot of sites that seem somewhat not that legitimate that are just taking the fear itself and putting it into a boilerplate page. It says, if you have fear of belly button lint, then you can talk to one of our specialists on belly button lint fears.
Right.
And, you know, just repeats the phrase.
Whatever the phrase, search phrase was, they put a page up that makes that search phrase work.
Exactly. But it's just fascinating to see this data. It goes to one of the issues we have with surveys today, which is cognitive dissonance, or people always want to be perceived in the best possible light. And as a market researcher by trade, this has been always one of the biggest challenges for our trade is getting past that and getting to what people really think. And one of the only ways you can do that is by analyzing this aggregate user behavior and what people actually think. So, I think you really can get to things like decision processes. And
you talk about that a lot in the book, and that's one of those things where when you get a survey of people together, either by phone randomly or you pull them in, they operate in ways that aren't really how they feel or how they think. And that's what you're talking about, cognitive dissonance. They do something different than what they're actually feeling. Like answer a question, I do like that kind of music, when they don't.
Right.
And so in this kind of sense, you're not actually asking people, you're just looking at what they do and therefore gathering from what they do real data, potentially.
Right. And I think there's so much valuable information there. The one challenge, though, is you have to make the inference. So a great example there, fear of intimacy. It may not be the individual's got that fear when they're searching on it. It could be they have a concern about their significant other having mm-hmm. a fear of intimacy. So there is some wiggle room in this analysis, and there's an art to analyzing the data. And we go into this in the book, things like the Stacy-Keibler correction coefficient, which we have to apply when we're trying to correlate popularity with search term data. So one of the exercises that we started to do, this actually came up while I was on the road preparing a presentation in Dallas for a travel conference. In the background, while I was preparing my presentation in my hotel room, Dancing with the Stars was on. And at some point in doing my slides, I thought to myself, well, if Dancing with the Stars is determined, a portion of it's determined, the results determined by popularity in terms of phone-in votes, text votes, searches, and people going to the website and actually voting for one of their favorite contestants, then my search term data should correlate to popularity. And if that's true, I should be able to predict who's going to win. And so it was the night of the finale. I did my analysis. Stacy-Keibler was the number one searched on of the three finalists. And so I made a proclamation that she was going to win. And she didn't. She came in third.
Interesting.
So we did a little postmortem analysis on my prediction. And when we did a search term suggestion for Stacy-Keibler in our data, it was like the Palin effect. People were looking for photos of Stacy-Keibler, hot photos of Stacy-Keibler.
They thought she was interesting, but not necessarily worth winning.
Right. And so then we convened the analyst group, and we decided to come up with what we now call the Stacy-Keibler correction coefficient, which we looked through the data to infer intent. What are people doing when they're searching?
Yeah, so you don't just use the raw number.
And since we've been very successful, except for a few instances, in predicting American Idol winners, subsequent Dancing with the Stars winners. And we actually have, the executives of the company got a little nervous at one point. What's our head of research doing off on this tangent, doing reality show television predictions? Because I was doing it, a lot of them. There's actually some real-world applications to this. Like, we've been able to successfully predict unemployment rates, the unemployment claims number that comes out Thursday by the Department of Labor based on how people are searching for unemployment. We've been able to predict existing home sales, new home sales, based on internet behavior. So there actually is some real-world application.
Interesting. What about stocks?
Stocks, difficult. In some instances, rare instances, for companies that are traded publicly that primarily just sell online, we can predict revenues. Stock, and there's so much that goes into a stock price.
Right.
You can't really get to stock price, but you can predict revenues. And we have been able to look for deltas or differences between what the street thinks a company's revenues are going to be and what our data tells it's going to be. Because if average sale price stays the same and the number of visits to a transaction stays the same, then our visit number should correlate really
tightly. So do you have online news organizations coming to you asking about this sort of data? And
financial institutions, news organizations, you know, writing for Time, I actually use this data to inform editorial decisions.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I'll figure out what I'm going to write based on what people are searching for. Because I know that I'm then developing content that's tailor-made to what the demand is.
And are you investing in those things where you find that the Wall Street is differing from your research?
I have no comment on
that. Bill, I mean, this is a way to keep corporations honest, too.
Yeah, in a way. But, you know, again, there's a lot of wiggle room, and it's a pretty isolated case that you can predict revenues on a company.
Okay.
Yeah, it's there's so many things that have to happen, line up correctly in order for you to be able to do that.
You know, Bill, one thing that struck me is that you work in a company that deals in hard facts, statistics, math, but you talk a lot about playing, you talk about reality TV shows. That's a cognitive dissonance right there. Yeah,
it is. You know, the company had to get used to the fact that I'm kind of quirky in that way. But, you know, it kind of these weird, quirky things we come up with bring life to the data. And actually, I think seed a lot of possibilities of what's exactly possible with this data when you can come up with the fact that maybe we can predict a reality television show using internet usage behavior.
Well, it seems to me, too, that the dry math isn't just all there is. There's something outside of that, and that's what you're bringing to it.
Right. There's that art. So there's that interpretation of the data. And it's challenging, too. Like you mentioned in the beginning, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges for us is the narrative fallacy, which is you get so in love with an idea, you can find some data points that will support that idea, no matter how outrageous.
Cherry-picking data is actually a big science problem. I mean, it can be.
So, you know, we're constantly reminding ourselves as analysts of this data to back away from the problem and look for both things that confirm or might disprove the hypothesis that we've come up with.
And that's the job of an analyst. I mean, that is a very difficult thing to do, to really look at large data and stuff. You know, we only have a few more minutes in the show, but I was really fascinated by this map that actually Matt Hindeman and Anthony Hayes did about blogs and how they link to each other and how the traffic flows. Can you describe a little bit about
this? Absolutely. And this is one of the best things we did at Hitwise is we opened up our data to some academics. So if you're working at a university, you can call me and I'll find a way to get you access to the data if you can come up with some interesting use for it. Mm-hmm. And so Matt Hinman, who works at Arizona State, looked at our politics data and he was able to create this three-dimensional map of how people traverse the political blogosphere. And it was really fascinating when he did it. What he did is he took about 1,000 sites within our political blog category, coded them by ideology, so he had left, right, and centric, and then showed the interconnectedness of all of these blogs to one another.
The strengths of their interconnectedness.
And then when you did that, you could see which blogs actually show up as sort of the as the central point, as where people are traversing through to get to information. But what's really interesting, what doesn't show up in the book, which we've just been analyzing recently, is looking at time series for that exact same data.
Oh, interesting.
And here's what's really fascinating about this and why I can't predict a presidential election is the closer you get to the actual election, the more crossover traffic happens. So if you were to run a movie of this, the complexity of those connections grow immense the closer you get to election because people are bouncing back and forth to different ideologies.
Right.
Both in terms of trying to decide but also arming themselves with checking out opposing viewpoints and then forming their arguments based on that.
Our author today was Bill Tanser. His book is Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. You can go to geekspeak.org to find out more. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thanks for having me.
The Geeks Today, Miles Elam, Rick Kleffel, and Sean Cleveland. My name is Lyle Troxell. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly hour-long radio quiz program. Each week on the radio, you can test your knowledge against some of the best and the best and brightest in the news and entertainment world while figuring out what's real news and what's made up. On the web, you can play along, too. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Saturday at noon and Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio. Broadcasting in HD Radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Auto, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Really quick, Rick, what are you doing on Sunday's show?
This Sunday, I'm speaking with the 10 of the 12 women who wore the necklace. These 12 women went in and bought a $37,000 diamond necklace, shared it for 28 days per year. Their story is really fascinating.
Oh, very cool. So the traveling necklace.
Yes.
That's an Agony Column on Sundays at 6 p.m. on KUSP. I'll be back next week along with the geeks, and we'll see you online until then. Thanks for listening.